am moved by fancies that are curled around these images and cling. The notion of some infinitely gentle, infinitely suffering thing. T.S. Eliot, from Preludes 4. These chapters put forth an argument for extending the study of American literature into what I hope will be a wider landscape. I want to draw a map, so to speak, of a critical geography and use that map to open as much space for discovery, intellectual adventure, and close exploration as did the original charting of the New World without the mandate for conquest. I intend to outline an attractive, fruitful, and provocative critical project, unencumbered by dreams of subversion or rallying gestures at fortress walls. I would like it to be clear at the outset that I do not bring to these matters solely or even principally the tools of a literary critic. As a reader, before becoming a writer, I read as I had been taught to do. But books revealed themselves rather differently to me as a writer. In that capacity, I have to place enormous trust in my ability to imagine others and my willingness to project consciously into the danger zones such others may represent for me. I am drawn to the ways all writers do this. The way Homer renders a heart-eating cyclops so that our hearts are wrenched with pity. The way Dostoevsky compels intimacy with Svidrigaïlov and Prince Myshkin. I am in awe of the authority of Faulkner's Benji, James's Maisie, Flaubert's Emma, Melville's Pip, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Each of us can extend the list. I am interested in what prompts and makes possible this process of entering what one is estranged from and in what disables the foray for purposes of fiction into corners of the consciousness held off and away from the reach of the writer's imagination. My work requires me to think about how free I can be as an African-American woman writer in my genderized, sexualized, wholly racialized world. To think about and wrestle with the full implications of my situation leads me to consider what happens when other writers work in a highly and historically racialized society. For them, as for me, imagining is not merely looking or looking at, nor is it taking oneself intact into the other. It is, for the purposes of the work, becoming. My project rises from delight, not disappointment. It rises from what I know about the ways writers transform aspects of their social grounding into aspects of language, and the ways they tell other stories, fight secret wars, limb out all sorts of debates blanketed in their text, and rises from my certainty that writers always know, at some level, that they do this. For some time now, I have been thinking about the validity or vulnerability of a certain set of assumptions conventionally accepted among literary historians and critics and circulated as knowledge. This knowledge holds that traditional, canonical American literature is free of, uninformed, and unshaped by the 400-year-old presence of first Africans and then African-Americans in the United States. It assumes that this presence, which shaped the body politic, the Constitution, and the entire history of the culture, has had no significant place or consequence in the origin and development of that culture's literature. Moreover, such knowledge assumes that the characteristics of our national literature emanate from a particular Americanness that is separate from and unaccountable to this presence. There seems to be a more or less tacit agreement among literary scholars that because American literature has been clearly the preserve of white male views, genius, and power, those views, genius, and power are without relationship to and removed from the overwhelming presence of Black people in the United States. This agreement is made about a population that preceded every American writer of renown and was, I have come to believe, one of the most furtively radical impinging forces on the country's literature. The contemplation of this Black presence is central to any understanding of our national literature and should not be permitted to hover at the margins of the literary imagination. These speculations have led me to wonder whether the major and championed characteristics of our national literature, individualism, masculinity, social engagement versus historical isolation, acute and ambiguous moral problematics, the thematics of innocence coupled with an obsession with figurations of death and hell, are not in fact responses to a dark, abiding, signing Africanist presence. It has occurred to me that the very manner by which American literature distinguishes itself as a coherent entity exists because of this unsettled and unsettling population. Just as the formation of the nation necessitated coded language and purposeful restriction to deal with the racial disingenuousness and moral frailty at its heart, so too did the literature, whose founding characteristics extend into the 20th century, reproduce the necessity for codes and restriction. Through significant and underscored omissions, startling contradictions, heavily nuanced conflicts, through the way writers peopled their work with the signs and bodies of this presence, one can see that a real or fabricated Africanist presence was crucial to their sense of Americanness. And it shows.